I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. My grandfather used a hearing aid. He was grateful for it, but not always. I learned a lot more about him as I grew up. I learned that he was in early childhood when he lost much of his ability to hear, and then years later, as an adult, he received his first device. Hearing was a blessing and a curse to him once he had that hearing aid. He described how difficult it was once, adjusting to this new experience of hearing, just to hear the rustle of leaves blowing in the wind. The stimulus was just too much aurally. This was a brave new world, and I'm just trying to imagine what he went through. Clearly, he had to learn how to navigate his way through the world in an entirely new way. It was clear to me that he always valued being able to tune out mechanically just by turning down the volume on his hearing aid, sometimes just down, sometimes completely off. He was a man who kept his own counsel. He valued some privacy of his thoughts and feelings, a little bit of silence from time to time. But when necessary, he would check back in with the world around him and turn it right back up. Well, we have with us now a guest who has a lot to teach us about these kinds of experiences. Dr. Sue Berry is with us. She's a retired professor emeritus of biology and neuroscience at Mount Holyoke College. She is a scientist, obviously, a writer, too, who speaks frequently and far and wide on topics such as neuroplasticity and binocular vision. Sue Berry is author of the book Coming to Our Senses, A Boy Who Learned to See, A Girl Who Learned to Hear, and How We All Discover the World. Sue Berry, a pleasure to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
We are going to talk about that boy and that girl of the subtitle. Clearly, that's part of what we want to do. But you have your own story of having to deal with this kind of, I hardly know what to call it, a paradigm shift, a brave new world, to borrow from Shakespeare. What was your story?
So my story is that I was cross-eyed or had a condition called strabismus from the first days of infancy on. And that meant that I would look at the world with one eye and turn the other eye into my nose, which meant that the two eyes were giving me two very different pictures of the world. And as a result, all through my childhood and through a great deal of my adulthood, I would look with one eye and then I would suppress the vision from the other eye so that I only had a single view of the world. But it was a much flatter view of the world than most people have, because I wasn't using the two eyes together. So I didn't have stereo vision or stereopsis, which is the kind of 3D effect that you experience, most people experience every day, and also experience if they go to a 3D movie and put on the 3D glasses. And it has long been thought that a child like I was, who was strabismic, who did not use the two eyes together and did not develop stereo vision as an infant or young child, could never develop stereo vision. That the brain lost that plasticity, by the age of 6 or 8, somewhere in that realm. But then when I was 48 years old, I went through a program of vision therapy with a developmental optometrist. And to my utter astonishment, I learned to coordinate my eyes like most people do, and to point the two eyes at the same place in space at the same time, and I developed stereo vision. I could see the space between falling snowflakes. If I looked in the mirror, I saw my reflection no longer on the glass of the mirror, but behind the mirror in the reflected space. And I have to tell you, these experiences brought me like a childlike glee. I had no idea how beautiful the world could look when you could see it in all of its dimensions. Space inflated. The distance between things got bigger. It was just an amazing, breathtaking experience.
But was it easy? Was it easy for you to encounter those new experiences?
Yes and no. It was, in many ways, overwhelming. It was kind of exhausting. And I noticed that after a day, after my vision changed and I kept looking, I mean, just looking, the door would open and I could see it coming toward me in 3D. I'd look down at my salad and I could see the roundness of the tomatoes and whatever else was in the salad. all of these experiences were spectacular, but they were also kind of overwhelming. And I remember coming home from work, let's say, and in my previous days, I would turn on the radio to catch up on the news and stories of the day. And I found I was just too tired to do that. I just wanted to listen to some familiar music, for example. In order to develop this stereo vision, I'd had to work very hard with a variety of different exercises to learn how to move my eyes in a coordinated fashion. So yes, the experience did not just happen. It required a lot of effort on my part. And the result was both for me incredibly gratifying, but also somewhat exhausting.
Now, you said that you were 48 when this happened.
Right.
Was it for you until that time in your life? Was it just a foregone conclusion that this kind of a thing could never happen?
Yes. The basic dogma in both the medical and the biomedical community was that stereo vision had to develop within the first years of life, that it could not develop later, and certainly in midlife, as it did with me. And these ideas were based on experiments, were based on really two types of evidence. One were experiments done on animals that were made cross-eyed or wall-eyed, made to have misaligned eyes, or animals in which one eye was occluded for long periods of time in infancy. And then the changes that they were then looked at in the brain seemed to indicate that the brain now took on a new way of dealing with information, a new way of seeing, and that this new way of seeing, a more monocular way of seeing, prevented the development of stereo vision. And it was also based on experiences with young children who had had operations like I did. I had three operations when I was 2, 3, and 7 years old, which moved the eyes in the sockets to try to make the eyes less crossed or less wall-eyed, to make the eyes straighter. And these operations most often did not result in the child developing stereo vision. So the assumption from that was that, oh, you could straighten the eyes of a child, but it was too late. Unless those operations were done in the first year of life or so, it was too late. The child brain could not develop stereo vision.
So a little bit earlier, you used the expression that you suppressed vision in one eye in order to be able
Correct.
To focus with the other. How do you do that? How do you suppress vision in one eye? Is that just something you do within your head?
It's an unconscious sort of thing. It's an unconscious process. It wasn't. In fact, some people who have misaligned eyes actually will sort of squint one eye shut, which is why in England, in Great Britain, the condition of strabismus is often called squint. And in fact, my father, when he developed crossed eyes in his 80s, I noticed it right away because he was squinting one eye shut. The squinting of one eye shut might be just sort of a precursor to then what the brain is able to do, which is to simply that input is coming in from, let's say, both of your eyes, but somehow the brain does not allow the input from one of the eyes to reach consciousness. The mechanism for that is not well understood.
Yeah. Did you feel when you made this change after the therapy, did you feel that one eye was kind of catching up to the other one? Was one eye working harder than the other?
Not in my case, because I was an alternator, which meant that some of the time I looked with my right eye and turned in and suppressed the left eye. And then the rest of the time I looked with my left eye and I turned in and suppressed the right eye. So I always retained good acuity in both eyes. I was using both eyes. I just didn't use them at the same time. So I did notice that, you know, my eyes would get tired from this new way of moving them about and coordinating them. But I didn't notice this experience to be stronger, let's say, in one eye versus the other.
Now, the technical aspects of how this was achieved in therapy, that could be very interesting to pursue. I'm not going to. It could be very interesting to pursue what is all the science behind a cochlear implant. We're not going to do that either, because I kind of think that what's really interesting at the moment is the fact that you and the boy and the girl you talk about, and even my grandfather that I was talking about, these people with these kinds of experiences, they have got to cope with a major shift in their lives, and that is dramatic.
Exactly. In fact, for me, I was a scientist. I developed this new way of seeing, but I had always been a sighted person. When I learned to see with the two eyes, everything made sense for me. That is, I always could judge whether one object was in front of another, because you have many, many clues to do that. The object in front blocks the object behind. An object further away looks smaller, and so on. So I had ways to judge the depth order of things. And when I gained stereo vision, now I could also see the space between things. But yet, a person like Liam, who I describe in Coming to Our Senses, or Zora, who received a cochlear implant and learned to hear at the age of 12, for them, they were experiencing sensations and a whole sensory system that was practically novel for them. And so their initial sensations did not make sense. They were just bombarded with new sights or new sounds, which they couldn't initially identify or make sense of. That is an extraordinary situation to be in.
Yeah, I can only, well, I try to imagine these things. I can only imagine. We are going to talk about Liam. We're going to talk about Zora in a bit. But I really want you to talk about that steering wheel and what happened. This is, I guess it was the very first time that you started seeing 3D.
That's right. And I described this in my book, Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions, which I published in 2009. And the story you're referring to happened, it happened the day after my 48th birthday. And what had happened is I had gone in for a vision therapy session in which I was learning how to coordinate my two eyes, learning how to point the two eyes at the same place in space at the same time. And after I had finished that vision therapy session, it was quite intense, and I was making a lot of progress. I went into my car to drive home, and I sat down, and I looked at the steering wheel, and it was floating in front of the dashboard. There was this palpable volume of space between the dashboard and the steering wheel, and I had never seen that before. And I closed one eye, and everything looked more normal. That is normal to me, where the steering wheel looked more, you know, it was in front of the dashboard. It blocked part of my view of the dashboard, but I didn't see that volume of space, that pocket of space between the steering wheel and the dashboard. I opened my eyes, both eyes, and the steering wheel was there floating in front of it. And it was about sundown. That was the time of day this was. And I thought, you know, the sun is coming into the car at a funny angle, and this must be giving me a strange illusion. Because, like I said, it was the day after my 48th birthday, and I knew all about the critical period, the idea that stereo vision had to develop early in life, before the end of this critical period, or it could never develop. And that critical period was over with by the time you were 6 or 8 years old, and I was just 48. And I thought, this is impossible. I can't be seeing in stereo. The next morning, I got up. I did my vision therapy exercises. I went in the car to drive to work, and I went to adjust the rear view mirror, and it was floating in front of the window. And at that point, from that point on, I began to see all sorts of things in stereo.
I'm trying to think of something analogous in my own experience to this, and the closest I can come is that when we're very young, we not just young, but There's a lot of tricks in various toys. I'm thinking of a little device called a ViewMaster we used to have as kids, mm-hmm. with those little discs, and you could see in stereo vision. And in retrospect, it seems kind of strange that I would want to peer into one of those things. They look like little binoculars, and you crank through the images. And the idea that something would pop out in stereo and that would amuse me, given the fact that the entire world, from my experience, can be seen in 3D. So what's the point, you know?
Right, right. There are many stereo fanatics out there in the world. They're members of the National Stereoscopic Association and so on, who have excellent 3D vision and yet get a huge kick out of ViewMasters and 3D movies and become excellent 3D photographers and videographers and so on. Yes, it's a fun experience for many, many people, even though they see in 3D on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we will talk next about Liam and his vision, about Zora and her hearing, marvelous stories, and we'll hear them from Sue Berry after this short break here on Constant Wonder. Sue Berry is the author of Coming to Our Senses, A Boy Who Learned to See, A Girl Who Learned to Hear, and How We All Discover the World. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. A pleasure to be with you, and a pleasure to be with Dr. Sue Berry. She's author of Coming to Our Senses, A Boy Who Learned to See, A Girl Who Learned to Hear, and How We All Discover the World. I want to just zero in on that word all. These are anomalous situations from the standpoint of people who are not hearing impaired or who don't have issues with vision. But you say it's about how we all discover the world. Are these experiences really translatable over to people who don't have those kinds of situations?
That's a great question and something I've thought about a lot. And my answer to it is yes, absolutely. And the reason is that some of the things that Liam and Zora experienced are probably somewhat close, or the way they had to learn to make sense of the world gives us an indication of how we had to learn to make sense of the world as little infants. We did a great deal of our learning to see and our learning to hear within the first few years of life, a period of time that none of us can remember. And so we get the impression that, oh, we just open our eyes and see. It's just a mechanical process. Photons hit the retina, and that causes a bunch of neurochemical changes that signal to our brain that we are seeing, and we are seeing a chair, and we are seeing a picture, and we are seeing a tree, and so on. It seems so effortless. The same with hearing. Oh, sure. Sound waves come into our ears. They rattle the eardrum, and that sets in motion a whole bunch of mechanical and chemical and electrical events, and we hear. And it's not that simple. What Liam and Zora's stories teach us is that the information that our eyes and our ears provide is just this basic raw stimuli. When Liam, who was practically blind from birth, first began to see well following surgery at age 15, what did he see? He saw edges and lines. That is the difference between light and dark. Or any area where you see a change in colors or change in shades between colors or change in texture between places. These created boundaries or edges, what he described as lines. What he saw was lines and patches of colors. That's what our eyes give us. Then we have to take that information and somehow from it create a sense of the whole, that those lines and edges are creating, that they come together to form objects and landscapes and animals and people. The same with sounds. When Zora, who was born profoundly deaf, first received a cochlear implant at age 12, she started to hear sounds. But to her, all of those sound waves were meaningless and disembodied. She would hear, let's say, a motor from a car and a person's voice and a bird singing, and all that information's coming into her ears at once. That's the raw stimuli, those sound waves coming into her ears all at once. And yet for most of us, we take that information and somehow we say, oh, those particular sound waves belong to the bird that's calling, and those belong to the motor in the car that I'm riding in, and those belong to the voice of my companion who's talking to me as we're riding in the car or whatever. So somehow we create a great deal of meaning out of this raw stimuli. And that's a process that begins from the moment of birth, or even with hearing, perhaps before birth. It's a process that somehow we develop in those first years of life, a period of time, like I said, where we have no memory of doing it.
Well, this work that the mind does really is work. And I it's a synthesis where the stimuli then somehow form a composite. And I'm wondering, because you had the experience with all of your training and your science, and suddenly you're 48, did it strike you as work to do this kind of mental activity, this processing?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because when I began to see in stereo, the process of learning how to coordinate my eyes was a lot of work. But the result, starting to see things in stereo, seemed to just happen. And I think that's because I already had an understanding of the landscape around me. I knew which objects were, let's say, pretty close to me and which objects were further away. And more than that, I knew what those objects were. That's a tree over there. That's a person. That's whatever. That wasn't, of course, the case for Liam when he first began to see. So for me, what happened was I went from seeing a landscape that I understood to a landscape that I understood even better. And so that process of actually seeing the pockets of space between things, seeing how things were arranged in space better, seemed not to be effortful. Even though the process of learning how to coordinate my eyes to get that to happen was very effortful.
So not effortful, but still taxing, at least physiologically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And also, like I said, it was exhausting. You know, so after a day of seeing in stereo, I was pretty tired. An analogy I would use to that is, if you've ever traveled to a foreign city, that's completely different than where you're normally used to living. Perhaps people are speaking a different language. Everything is different than it is at your home. By the end of the day, you would be pretty tired.
Yeah,
and
overload.
That's right. That kind of sensory overload is something that I did experience.
Well, I'm going to do something kind of different here before we talk about Liam and Zora more. Can we just jump to what they became professionally? Because this is so impressive. After these changes in their lives and their sensory perception, they went places. Where'd they go?
Liam was 15 when he had his operations and began to see with fairly normal acuity. And he went to college. And after college, he began to work in a vision lab. And he works in a vision lab to this day. And what's amazing to me is the work that Liam does is highly visual. So what he does is that he is, of course, very interested in vision, wants to do whatever work he can to help other people see better, like he sees today. And so he works in a lab where people study the retina, the nerve cells in the back of the eyes that actually absorb the light and start the whole process of vision. And the retina is made up of many, many different types of cells and layers of cells. And each of those nerve cells has, you know, a cell body and then all of these processes, axons and dendrites that radiate from it. And what Liam does is he helps to reconstruct, using cross sections of the retina, he helps to reconstruct the whole three-dimensional shape of an individual neuron. It's a demanding and highly visual process. It's a highly visual task, and yet he really enjoys it, and he's really good at it.
And Zora's career?
Zora was a student of mine at Mount Holyoke. That's how I met her. And so when I met her, she was about 20 years old. It was about 10 years after she received her cochlear implant. And after she graduated from Mount Holyoke, she spent 1 year working at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Institute as a researcher in hearing. And then she went back to her native Tanzania. And in Tanzania, she went to medical school. It's a 5-year program in Tanzania. She got her MD degree, and she may well be the very first deaf doctor in Tanzania. After getting her medical degree, she moved to Toronto, Canada, where most of her family now lives. And she is pursuing various biomedical jobs in Canada. She's not quite sure how she's going to use her medical degree in sort of a more long-term permanent way, but it's definitely going to be in a way that will help other people.
So often when we hear stories of other people's successes, overcoming challenges and what have you, we like to think, well, happily ever after. And of course, these are people who still have a road ahead of them in life and lots of experiences yet to come. I'm wondering if we can focus in now in these two stories of Liam and Zora on what was most complicating in the plot of their lives early on when they were approaching this big change or getting through the change. What was so difficult for them in their stories of having their sensory capacities expanded?
For Liam, it was an overwhelming amount of sensory information coming in, visual information coming in. Like I said, what he saw after his surgeries was lines and patches of colors as if they were on one flat plane. It wasn't like he looked out and saw a chair and knew it was a chair. What he saw were the edges of the chair and the colors in the chair. And he actually had to consciously put together, oh, I'm looking at a chair. When he would be walking down a sidewalk and he'd see a crack in the sidewalk, what he saw was a line in the sidewalk. Was that line a crack in the sidewalk? Was it the place between two sidewalk blocks? Or was it a shadow? Or was that line an indication of stepping off a curb? Was it a step that was going down, or was it a step that was going up? As he's walking, he's thinking, should I step over that line? Should I step up? Should I step down? Or maybe it's just the shadow and I should just ignore the line. So you can see that every moment of time, every movement that he had to make required him to take in this new information and figure out what was going on before he could even, you know, make the next move. And so it was overwhelming.
And with Zora, there was such support in her family story. I guess an aunt took her under her wing and helped her along even before getting to the point of the cochlear implant. But what can you tell us about what's analogous to stepping over that line in the sidewalk for Zora?
For Zora, first of all, one really interesting thing that Zora told me is she was 12 years old. She has the operation. She now has the cochlear implant, and the day comes to turn it on. And she knows, because the audiologist tells her, and Zora could lip read, and she had a good command of English. So the audiologist tells her, you're going to hear a beep. And then they send a sort of electronic beep through the cochlear implant. And what does Zora hear? Well, what she experienced was a sensation. She called it a feeling in her head. She had by this time, whatever hearing she had had as a small child had been such a distant memory. She really had no memory of what it was like to hear. And so when that beep first went through her cochlear implant, she experienced this uncanny, nerve-wracking feeling. And she looked over at her mom, who was at, and the audiologist, and she saw their lips moving, and she had that same uncanny feeling again. The audiologist then sent another beep through the cochlear implant, and Zora knew she was supposed to be hearing a beep. And so when that second one happened, she thought, this must be hearing. And later that day, they walk out of the medical center. They're on the streets of Toronto because that's where she had her cochlear implant surgery and so on. They're on the streets of Toronto, and there's all of this noise, all of these sounds coming into her cochlear implant, but she can't make sense of any of them. It was just an unintelligible cacophony. She woke up the next morning, and she didn't want to put in her cochlear implant. She couldn't understand what other people found so meaningful from all of this noise. She didn't have the ability that we all have, whether we're conscious of it or not, to tune out environmental noises that aren't important to us. Right now, you might be hearing, oh, I don't know, I can hear, if I listen, my computer fan right now, or you might hear ventilation, you know, in the room you're in, or whatever, and you tune it out because it doesn't, it's not important to you. But when she first put on that cochlear implant, you know, the second day, all of these noises just bombarded her, and they made no sense. And she didn't have any way to know what to filter in and what to filter out. She just wanted to take the implant off and throw it away. And it was only because her family was there to really encourage her that she kept the implant in place. And after about 2 weeks, she started to feel a little bit more comfortable with all the noises she was hearing.
And you heard her tell this firsthand?
Oh, yes. She was, what happened was she was one of my students and at Mount Holyoke College. And very early on, well, on the first day of class, I came into the classroom and I started to, give my lecture. And there was this student in the front row who kept looking at me, like, intensely. And it was unnerving for me. I kept thinking, what is wrong? Did I, you know, I'd look down at my clothes. Is everything okay? And then I realized, oh, that is Zora. Because she had stopped by my office a few days before to tell me she wore a cochlear implant and that she was deaf, but she was hearing through the implant. And so then I realized, oh, that's Zora. And she is looking at me so intensely because she is both hearing what I'm saying and reading my lips. And a few days later, Zora came into my office to turn in an assignment for class. And when she turned around, I said, Zora, could you tell me your story? And she gave me this little smile as if to say, yes, of course, but no one has ever asked. And so from that time on, we would meet in my office periodically, and I'd get out my notebook, and she would tell me more and more stories about her life. And then that continued over email. And when she moved to Toronto, then I went to visit her and her family, which was a spectacular experience. And in that way, I got to know all of her stories, or many of her stories.
That moment you just described, where suddenly she smiles and says, nobody has ever asked, to think that people go through these changes, the story before the change, the months or years afterward, and don't get to tell their stories.
That's right.
That's got to be that's a complicating factor itself.
That's right. And telling their stories, I felt, was a way not just to celebrate them, but to sort of make people more aware of the fact that each of us perceives the world in our own way. I mean, we all have to learn how to take that raw stimuli that comes in through our eyes and ears and construct the world from it. And since we all come from different environments and have different needs, all of us develop our perceptions in our own unique way. By telling Zora and Liam's stories, I'm hoping to bring out that point as well.
Dr. Sue Berry, a retired professor emeritus of biology and neuroscience at Mount Holyoke College. She's author of Coming to Our Senses, A Boy Who Learned to See, A Girl Who Learned to Hear, and How We All Discover the World. I very much like the idea that coming to one's senses is more than just a metaphor. So that raises the question, is losing your senses more than just a cliche? We're going to tackle that question when we return to Constant Wonder in just a moment. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We all now know a few more things than we ever wanted to know about COVID. And one feature, a classic symptom actually, and we've all heard about this, is the fact that people often lose their senses, or at least they lose their sense of taste and their sense of smell. And these can take a long time to come back. And sometimes they come back a bit different from the way they were when you were pre-COVID. To learn more about this, we spoke with Danielle Reed. Reed is an associate director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia.
I'm really interested in how it happens, you know, exactly what happens inside the nose or on the tongue that causes us to lose these cells. So that's a really interesting question to me, like the mechanism of what's happening. And then, of course, we want to figure out how to get people better. And so I've also been working a lot trying to understand what kind of therapies might be effective and how can we can think creatively about trying to waken up these missing cells and try to get new cells born and get people recovered.
You're talking about these cells, and this already opens up a door of understanding for me because the location of these cells, are you talking about the receptor cells that are in the nose or in the tongue, or is this also a matter of – because I had thought potentially this virus could change the interpretive functions deep in the brain that interpret smells.
Yes. So you've really hit on the two competing ideas here. One is that the cells in the nose and tongue have died or not working correctly so that the signal has no chance of getting to the brain. And then the competing other idea is that somehow the brain is infected with the virus and doesn't interpret this information correctly. And the first look that we've had at the cells in the nose suggests that the cells in the nose are actually, what's happening is that they have these beautiful structures on them called cilia, and they look kind of like seaweed floating in the ocean, or the sort of long, slender strands. And one of the first things that happens when these cells are the cells become infected with COVID, or the nearby cells get infected with COVID, is that these cilia drop off, and it's like and then the cells seem to die. And so there's no way for the signal to start, really, because those cells that are the first relay point for the sense of smell are gone. And these cells repopulate and they get reborn and come back, but they seem to do so very, very slowly, or, and of course, some people maybe not at all.
But I understand that your initial interest here and your area of expertise ties in this idea of being taste blind or having compromised sense of smell or taste, ties in with just our genetic inheritance.
Yes, absolutely. So this whole sort of line of study got started in a laboratory in DuPont in the 1930s. And this fellow called Arthur Fox was synthesizing a chemical that he needed to make some dyes. And he had one of those moments, I don't know, maybe if you're a cook or people in your life cook, but we've all had those moments where we're transferring a powder from a cup into a bowl and we're trying to tap it into the bowl. And then all of a sudden it goes poof, you know, it all flops out at once and goes in the air. And that happened in the lab. And Arthur Fox actually couldn't perceive or taste the chemical at all. But the fellow next door to him or the next bench over found it to be insanely bitter. And they both just looked at each other like, how can this be that one that Arthur Fox couldn't taste it and yet the other fellow could? And there was really no explanation for that because they both could taste other things just fine. Arthur Fox could taste other things. And so this taste loss seemed pretty selective for just this one thing, which was odd. And so, you know, he was thinking about it, and he was thinking, well, maybe it's the case that all of the different chemicals that we taste in our food, maybe there's different receptors for them that, you know, that respond in different ways. And maybe this receptor for this particular chemical in me is just broken. And, you know, that is exactly his idea of it. He had no idea about DNA or proteins or whatever, but his fundamental idea about it was exactly correct. It turns out that we have, just like some people are colorblind, there are people who are taste blind to very specific things. And this has a lot of implications for what people can taste and what they like to eat.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, the idea that any of this would be missing from our palette of experiences is a little alarming to me. I like to think of myself. I don't know how many people are like this, but I think of myself as I can taste anything, and my taste is going to be, you know, authoritative. If something is really good food, I'm going to say that's really good food, and I'm going to be able to tell you why. But there are going to be people who are mystified about the great interest in, say, foodies and foodie publications and programming. I mean, why would somebody watch hours and hours of programming content on TV or in podcasts or read books about taste? I would imagine there are some people who are just scratching their head and just don't get it.
Yes, absolutely. So there are people that have these very selective losses so that they can't taste very particular things. And so you can imagine those kind of conversations. Let's just take Brussels sprouts as a prime example. So for instance, I am not able to taste the bitterness of Brussels sprouts. You know, I was born that way. And when people used to talk to me about Brussels sprouts being bitter, I was just like, I don't even understand what you're talking about. Whereas other people just looking at me like, how can you not taste it? They're extremely bitter. And so then you can imagine that there are people that have these selective losses. And then there are people who either lose their sense of taste and smell through some event, you know, they have a head injury, or they have gotten a severe virus. Or some people are actually born without a sense of smell. That's the most common. And there are people born without a sense of taste too, but that's less common. And then, of course, it takes them a while to piece together their comparing their experience with others to really even learn that they don't have it, what it is to have a sense of taste or smell, and learn about that.
Can you give us some kind of a sense for how many people are we talking about? 0.1% of the population at large might be born without a sense of smell, or 0.00. Is it a very small fraction or a considerable fraction?
There's very few people that are born without a sense of smell, probably on the order of about 0.5%, maybe 0.3% of people. So this is actually quite uncommon. But what is very, very common is for people to have a head injury. And that will either permanently or near permanently reduce your sense of smell or eliminate it. And that's because the nerve that travels between the nose and the brain, these nerves are very soft, and they go through this hard bone that's basically looks like a colander, like you'd rinse vegetables in. And when your head is hit really hard, those very soft nerves come against that very hard bone, and they're often sliced or sheared off so that the nose and the brain no longer connect appropriately. And that type of head trauma is very common. So one of the ways you can screen for having too much, you know, in a football practice and that type of activity is to screen at the sense of smell to make sure that connection is still strong.
Do you know of anybody in the sports world who's already aware of this, so that when there's been a head injury that they look for that in particular?
I don't know the names of any individual people, but certainly we get letters all the time from athletes who have lost their sense of smell through head trauma. And of course, they're really curious about how the nerves can regrow and find the correct place in the brain, and whether they can revive their sense of smell.
Yeah, you know, there's been so much talk about concussions on the football field, and those discussions tend to focus on longevity. You know, is somebody going to have a shortened life? You know, will the brain have problems earlier in life, dementia, that sort of thing? I haven't heard anybody talking about, well, your quality of life could go down today with a head injury from a loss of sense of taste or smell.
Yes. I mean, the sense of smell is really, I like to think of it as a canary in the coal mine when it comes to head injury. And so one of the things that I would love to see is for our sense of smell, just a quick test in the doctor's office as part of our everyday type of physical exam. I think that would really help us understand a lot better to answer a lot of the questions that we have. I think it'd be, you know, fun thing to do while you're waiting for the doctor to show up in your room as you just had a quick smell test. I think that sounds like a little bit of fun and really good, really would help get us a lot of good data.
Yeah. I want you to take us to Ohio, to the Twin Days Festival in Twinsburg, Ohio. Have you been there or sent people there? What's going on there?
Yeah, so the Twins Day, I call it, it's a large country fair, and everybody that goes there is a twin. And so it's held every year in the first weekend of August. And it's just a ton of fun. Little kids start to go when they're really tiny. Their parents bring them, the twins, and then they come every year. And a lot of times they meet their husband or wife and fall in love and get married and come back. And it's just it's a really beautiful family event for the twins. And of course, as a geneticist, we love twins because it gives us a chance to measure people and to see if the twins, for things like their sense of smell and taste, are more similar. There's two kinds of twins. There's identical twins, and then there's what we call fraternal twins that are less genetically similar. So we like to compare those two types of twins to see if the things that we care about, taste and smell, are genetically determined.
And do you find any surprising information from the Twins Festival?
Yes. You know, one of the things that was surprising to me is as we ask sort of basic questions like how salty is it or how bitter is it or what does this smell like? And those things are more genetically determined for sure. But the big surprise is when we ask people like, how much do you like this? How much do you like this very sweet thing that we've given you? And when people are answering that question, there's a lot of genetic trait. There's a lot of genetic loading for that trait, too. So that was a big surprise to us. You know, we have this idea of people having sweet tooth, and that's kind of a fun idea. And people talk about this person as a sweet tooth or whatever. But there seems to be a real genetic or scientific basis for that.
Is it true that more people complain about food being too sweet than not sweet enough?
Yes, we actually, it was very funny. It was last winter, actually. You know, I was home and I was analyzing data just to look at things for fun. And I was looking at all of these Amazon food reviews. And I was interested in learning more about bitterness. But what I kept stumbling across was that people were really talking about sweetness in these food reviews. And I was like, well, you know, what are they saying? And as I was analyzing the data more and more, and again, just for fun, it seemed like people were complaining about 10 times more that the foods like, you know, cookies and other kinds of that kind of bag and box types of food were too sweet. And I thought that was so interesting, you know, because I imagine if you're a food manufacturer, you try to sweeten things so that everybody will like it. But it seems clear that many people are just finding food to be way too sweet. And I thought that was interesting.
You just mentioned some literature about food, and I'm just wondering if that's a source of data for you at all in your expertise. Do you read what food writers are putting out there? Does that help you at all?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things is that I like to say is you don't know what you don't know. And when people write about things and write about their experience, it gives scientists a really good way to generate hypotheses. So reading what people write about food, kind of we let go of our own ideas as scientists, and we just listen to what people have to say. So this is a really good source of data and information for us.
Well, I'm very interested in how people try to produce their own lives. They try to have custom-made experiences, you know. And I'm wondering if anything out of the science of genetics might help people to understand, oh, I'm this type of a taster. I'm this type of a smeller. And so I could probably kind of program my life that when I go shopping, I should get these kinds of foods, but not those kinds of, you know what I mean? Is there a way to use the science to help people on a daily basis pursue their own quality of life in very almost idiosyncratic ways?
You know, I think that there is going to be a place for this sort of customizing our own taste experience. But I like to think of the research taking us to a place more of compassion for each other. So we've all been, at least many of us are parents and many of us have kids. And I am a non-taster of this bitterness that's in Brussels sprouts, but my children both can taste it because they inherited one copy of that gene from their father. So to my children, the cruciferous vegetables like Brussels sprouts taste bitter, right? And so as a mother, I'm trying to get them to eat something that to me is delicious. I love all the cruciferous vegetables, but to them is bitter. And so I think there's a place for us to sort of take a minute and pause when we're trying to get, you know, kids or family members to try something or eat something, for us to just to understand that like the basic experience of food is very different from people. And so I think that's one thing that we're learning is just to be a little kinder, if you will, when we're trying to understand why certain people won't eat certain things.
Now, I've saved something scandalous for the very end here. Do you really have 4 freezers packed with human spit?
Indeed, I do. Yes, I have freezers full of spit. Yep.
How did that happen? You got to tell us how that happened.
Well, when back in the old times, we used to extract DNA from blood. And you can imagine that's hard on the people giving us blood, and it's hard on us because we have to handle it in a special way. And it turns out that basically, I always like to think of spit as liquid DNA. So there's a lot of DNA in spit, and it's very easy to collect, at least for most people. And so it's a way that we can look at your inborn genotype, all of your genetic code, in a way that's easy for us and easy for the subjects. But the bottom line is I do have 4 freezers full of spit, and that is quite something to look at.
Danielle Reed is Associate Director of the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. The end of World War II brought an end to hostilities with the defeat of Germany and then Japan, but the wartime alliance between Western democracies and the Soviet Union, totalitarian as it was, well, that rapidly dissolved. Imagine that. It was clearly a marriage of convenience from the get-go. And the focal point of the new conflict was the former German capital city of Berlin. What ensued was a season of espionage, betrayal, escape, courage, and of course there was that wall. Stories from divided Berlin are next when we come back to Constant Wonder after the news.